Live from the heart of Los Angeles, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright lights.
With tonight's guest, Disney interpretive artist, producer, and game art director, Joel Christopher Payne.
Night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Wagall. I am Mark Leger, and now our host, the MC, the Master of Change, Filippo Voltaggio.
Over the years, I think I have mentioned this maybe twice, and each time I mention it, it's developing. I'm sure the last time I mentioned it, I think I said it should turn into a blog someday, or who knows what, but it became so relevant today as I was talking to our guest, how irrelevant the question of what are you going to be when you grow up might actually be. So I'm not a parent. I am an adult, and I was a kid, and I know what that question did. Ironically, it kind of worked for me, but that's a whole, and definitely didn't kind of, that's for a whole other story. Maybe that's for the book, but for the moment here, why do I feel that asking a kid, actually, it's not just parents, it's teachers, it's adults, it's people around, hi, what do you want to be when you grow up? People think that that's a way to have a conversation with a child or start a conversation with a child. So here, real quickly, I've given one or two thoughts before. Here are five, maybe six, but I have a list of them somewhere. So first, it can give the impression that today isn't important, or what they are today or what they're thinking about today doesn't have importance. It's what they're going to be when they grow up that's important. Secondly, it could make them think that they're not somebody now. As a life coach, I've come to see so many people that have carried that, like, I'm not somebody now, but I will be once I graduate, or I will be once I get married, or I will be once I have this career, or I will be. And unfortunately, that could carry on for some people, a lot of people, and they never become anything, and they never stay, or they never get happy with this moment. I could be one of those. And thirdly, some things kids can only do now. If they want to play a kid in a kid show, they can only do that now. They can't do that when they grow up. So this is the time. Like, they want to be a, you know, kid in a play. That's a kid's part. That's now. That's not for when they grow up. How about this one? Many times, people could help pigeonhole the child into that. It's like, oh, you want to be that? Okay, then we'll give you this, we'll give you that. If the child says, hey, I'm interested in this, then it's a different conversation. Then we can support the child. That's how I feel. Again, I'm not a parent. As long as the kid isn't hurting himself or hurting other people, I think this is a way to have that conversation. And here's the biggest one, I think, is that the child's world might be small unless they come out of the chute saying, I'm going to be a this, and that might not be even invented yet. You know, then that gets into a problem too, because some people say, oh, you can't do that, or we don't have the money to put you to college to do that. Or so that those are things that just can grow. So some of the things that a kid in a small town, for example, a small world, might want to be, they don't know the big world. They don't know what's possible. So they'll pick something that's currently available to their imagination or their consciousness, or something that they see an adult doing. So here's one of the funny last things is, now, as an adult in this particular world, as things change, How many of us have kept the same job as the world is changing? So it's a moot point what I wanted to be maybe when I grew up. And I think the most exciting thing is that potentially a child, and I alluded to this, potentially a child has visions of something that is a benefit to them or the world or whatever that, again, hasn't been invented yet. Because the opposite is also true, that when we grow up, the job we thought we wanted might no longer be available because technology has made it obsolete, for example. So there it is. So in case you're saying, okay, so what do we ask? What's of interest to you today? Or what was interesting about today? Or what did you spend a lot of your day on? Or what has your attention these days or today? Things of that nature. You'll see why this becomes ever more relevant when we get into the conversation with our guest.
How about what makes you happy?
Oh.
How do you, yeah. What makes you smile? And you're right. I don't think I've ever thought about the fact that a child actor can't be a child actor when they grow up.
But yeah, I need to write that in my notes. What makes you happy? What makes you smile?
This is a super, super important conversation. I'm really excited to dive into this further. I think the reality is that nothing screams I'm not enough than asking a child, what are they going to be when they're really important later, like you said. So thank you for sharing that.
So how to get past your limitations. Surprise, surprise. That is the title of our episode 809 with our very special interview guest who is a Disney interpretive artist. He's a television producer. He's a video game art director veteran. He's CEO of Digital Backlot. He's so, so much more. Joel Christopher Payne. Welcome, Joel, to the Life Changes Show.
Hey, Filippo. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I am completely honored, especially with the subject that we're going to talk about. This is so core to who I am. So I'm excited about talking to your viewers about my life, because I really am an example of exactly what I'm going to be talking about.
Well, and to that point, at 4 years old, you had an aha experience or a life-changing experience. Let's just use our words, your words.
Yeah. Could have been a traumatizing experience, but instead it had the complete opposite effect. And I just recently started working with Garner Holt, who had a very similar experience that I did. So he was, he's the guy that does all the robots for Disney. A lot of the robots that you see, like the Nightmare Before Christmas overlay at Disneyland's Haunted Mansion. He did Jack Skellington. And so he's got robots all over the world, about 4,000 installations in amusement parks all over the world. The sun does not set on Garner Holt Productions. And this is a man who, like me, fell in love with Walt Disney. I guess he had seen a show that had Donny Osmond debuting the Haunted Mansion, and his parents planned on having him become a veterinarian because his family raised horses. And he saw this show on World of Color with Donny Osmond. And he said, please take me to Disneyland. So he went to see the Haunted Mansion. And once he got off of that ride, he was in his back seat and leaning over the seat saying, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life, Mom and Dad. And I think they were probably in shock because having a veterinarian in a family of horse breeders is a good way of saving money. But he had other plans, and he built an empire where there was no school that would teach him to do what he did. And he just did it. And that's, a lot of people have been influenced by my favorite guy that has changed the world so many different ways. Probably the most influential American in history, Walt Disney. And so I was on that ride, Pirates of the Caribbean. My mom had told me, she'd warned me about the robots and said, now, son, you're five. This might be a little scary. The robots, they're not real. So I got on that ride and I was in the Blue Bayou section, where they had the fireflies. And I was going down and I looked over to my mom. I said, Mom, the robots, they look so real. And without hesitation, my mom looks over at me and says, son, those are the waiters at the restaurant. So I had gotten confused. I didn't know what to expect being five. So we went a little further down the river and there was this old man rocking on a shack. And if anybody's been to Disneyland, you know what I'm talking about? I said, Mom, is that guy real? And she said, no, that's a robot. Well, it was in that moment that I couldn't tell the difference between fantasy and reality that I made a determination. I want to know how to do this. This is magic to me. This is like a cartoon for real. You know, this is believable fantasy. So I beelined to the art gallery and promised my mom that I would be a famous Disney artist. And lo and behold, decades later, that's exactly what I would become. I'm known all over the world. You know, all of the parks, every park that Disney has, Paris and China and you name it. There's one in Japan, and my artwork's in all the galleries all over the world, which is just a blessing to me. So that was a dream full circle realized for that. But it really came from Walt Disney's basic mode of operation. This is a man who didn't graduate high school. And I was getting D's and F's in high school at the time because I was a severe dyslexic. And back in the 80s, they didn't know how to deal with that. And so I kind of fell through the cracks until I got into college when they recognized that problem and we addressed it. But I was not a good student. But I had a lot of creativity. What I lacked in math skills, I made up in creative writing and art. That part of the brain took over. So, you know, now I take the lessons of Walt Disney, who all the experts at the time thought he was crazy to build Disneyland, to do the first animated movie. They all thought he was crazy. All the industry experts that should know how to do it said he was insane. But here he was achieving the impossible and doing a lot of things that nobody had ever considered and achieving his dreams despite all the wind blowing against him. So I used his life as a model for mine. And we have a lot of similarities, him and I, growing up. So I was raised on a ranch. He was raised on a ranch. So we got to fall in love with animals and appreciate nature. But that art skill set with me because I realized at a very early age that if I had a 2-cent piece of paper and a pencil, I could turn that into a $100 bill in about an hour with a beautiful work of art. And that means that I would never lose the opportunity of making a living, even if I was dirt broke. So that seemed like a really valuable skill to learn. That's where I started. That made a lot of sense to a guy that wasn't cut out for, you know, corporate bricklaying or anything like that. I wasn't set up for that.
Well, and glad and thankfully, because you were set up for exactly what you've done, which has brought a lot of joy to a lot of people. Ironically, that is one of your things. You like to support people and make them happy, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I am the maker of wondrous things. That's how people have titled me. And quite frankly, I love that title. You know, I've had a lot of nicknames over the years working in the video game business, Flash, Lightning Boy, because I'm very quick. But the maker of wondrous things has stuck all these years because I've had such a diverse career. I mean, I've worked in 5 different industries, movies, television, games, rides, fine art. So I've really run the gamut across a lot of different industries and held 35 different occupations in all those different categories at the highest level. So voiceover work and acting and directing and art directing, it's all been kind of in the mix. And I think that the smartest thing that I ever did is I didn't rush out to go work for the big companies. Instead, I chose artistically driven projects that were new companies. And the benefit of that was they needed a lot of people, but they couldn't afford a lot of people. So a guy of my many talents became kind of a universal Lego, and I survived a lot of the layoffs. I survived a lot of the layoffs because my hands and fingers were in everything and they couldn't get rid of me. So,
and it's being interesting, how day to day you were learning different skills, or in some cases, a lot of cases, creating different opportunities and creating different overwhelming, wonderful, wondrous things. So you were at the forefront of that. What do you think prepared you for that, other than the dream at 5 years old that I'm going to be a Disney artist?
Well, if I'm being completely honest, it was I had to be an artist or bust. It was one of those scenarios where I didn't have a backup plan. And quite frankly, I'd have to say that was probably the smartest thing I ever did because it really lit a fire under me where I had to do it. I just had to do it. I had no other options in life. You know, I could have worked in the fast food business and ran a grocery store at the end of my life. And I looked at my life and I thought, you know, what do I want to do where I'm leaving something of myself behind? You know, how am I going to make my mark in history and leave something? I didn't feel like, you know, when my father told me, you know, if you do things for yourself, when you die, it dies with you. And if you do things for others, it carries on. So that message really stuck with me. And I really started thinking about it. So for at least 28 years, I was kind of working for other people in the video game industry, working on games that probably nobody listening has ever heard. So like Mortal Kombat and Silent Hill.
Oh,
And
people know.
I'm
People
sure a
know.
few kids out there, their ears perked up real quick when they heard Mortal Kombat and Silent Hill. Those are epic. I also had the pleasure of working on being the establishing world art director for a pretty well-known game, Elder Scrolls Online, which is a $200 million budgeted MMO that competes with World of Warcraft. And so I got to establish the look of the world in the first 6 months of the project out there in Maryland, which was, you know, that's one good thing about the video game business. You're kind of like a military brat and you kind of travel around the country, see the world,
Well,
working
if
at
you
different
last
companies.
long enough, because
You're
normally
right.
people don't last very long, right?
True. The average lifespan in the video game business, kids, if you're thinking about it, is 4 years. That's all that the
4 years.
average person can handle it
And
because it's
you?
so intense. It's so 28. And so how did I survive all that?
Yeah, how
How
did you
did
survive all that?
I? So I there was a lot of stress. And when you're working in a bleeding edge company on the bleeding edge of technology, I mean, think about it. I started in the video game business when they had 16 colors on the computer back in the day. I had a Timex Sinclair with bubble buttons was my first computer back in the 80s. And then I got a Commodore 64 and then an Amiga 500 where the graphics really started coming online. We had 64 colors. And then when I got into the video game business, I was hired on my birthday, turned 21, working at New World Computing, working on Heroes of Might and Magic, and which is on its 11th sequel all these years later. And we had millions of colors and endless resolution. But as soon as we had those kind of roadblocks of limited resolution, all of a sudden 3D came onto the market. And now I was trying to figure out how to make a head out of five polygons instead of an eye, you know, a set of eyes with like 5 pixels without making it look like a unibrow. I mean, I've been through several revolutions, and now here we are with another one with AI coming on the scene. And I don't, you know, if you're not prepared for that, or if you're scared of it, then you've got big problems. People that don't adapt to change, well, they become cobblers in society. And we saw this in the Disney company. Since I do a lot of Disney stuff as a fine artist, I know a lot about the company's history. And back in the day, when computers were coming on the scene, everything was hand painted up to that point. But the team were told, "You're going to have to digitally paint these things. It's going to save us a lot of money. It's going to make us a lot more competitive and a lot more consistent. And we're going to have all these amazing shadowing effects and shading effects that we couldn't do if we hand painted this stuff." And a lot of the traditional artists just sat back and bucked the system. They said that that's going to take the art out of it because it's not hand painted. And those people don't work at the company anymore. And when they thought that computers were going to ruin the industry, out popped this small company called Pixar that now employs something like 3,000 people. You know, again, you got to evolve and roll with the punches and kind of anticipate where the market's going. So here we are with AI. What do you do with it? You know, the Hollywood knee-jerked and they got terrified, just like when the first movie came onto the scene with the Great Train Robbery and everybody ducked in the theater when the gun was pointed at the audience. You know, people don't understand what it is. But I think in time, people will realize the value of this tool because that's all it is. And they'll realize that we still need storytellers and they're still relevant. The storytellers still matter. We might not need a lot of the other bells and whistles, unfortunately, but with it, with evolution of technology, things just become easier and easier as we go. So
And
you
you'll
got.
be there for them, still working in the industry, creating all kinds of wonderful things when they're ready.
Right. And yeah, Stan Winston, who I had the pleasure of working with, he was a practical effects artist. He did some characters you might know, Terminator, Predator, Edward Scissorhands, you know, a few characters you might know. And
Yep.
he was always worried about computers taking him over. But he started doing CG on T3 right before his passing. And even today, you can see that practical effects still work really well, actually better than CG effects, you know, and that's why Favreau used a real puppet for Baby Yoda, you know, for Grogu versus CG. Now there is CG there, but there's something about a real physical thing you can interact with. And I think a lot in Beetlejuice is a good example of that. A lot of it's practical because he had no budget back then. So you don't need a lot of money, kids. You just need creativity and a good story. And that's all that really matters is a good story and actors that can pull that story off.
Your life is a good story, and you also have a lot of good stories to tell. And so the funny thing is, right now I'm going through my mind of what can I say, because I laugh how so much of our conversations have been, I can't talk about this yet, or I can't talk about this on air, or I can't. And so I'm trying to think, okay, what can I say? Because you've got
Yes.
so
All
much
right,
going
all right.
on.
I'll take the pressure off. I'll make it easy for you. I'll talk about the things I've been authorized to talk about because some of this stuff is world changing, no doubt about it. So one of the things is, and I will talk about the one world changing thing. So let's start off with what you started the show off with, which is, you know, you have one job, you know, this is what were your dreams when you were a kid? So when I go out and meet somebody, the first thing I do is I say, what do you do for a living? Because that's just a good start conversation starter. And I always get one of two answers. I'm either incredibly surprised by the answer because they have an awesome job, or they're, you know, they're in a job that they hate, that they absolutely hate. And I always ask them, well, why are you in that job? Like when you were a kid, what were your dreams? What was your dream job? And then I find out they had this whole other passion. I'm like, well, why didn't you pursue it? And then they say, well, you know, family business, I got roped into it. Now I'm selling cars for the rest of my life, and it's a living. People are doing themselves a horrible injustice. And it took me 40 years to realize I was doing that to myself as well. As much as I was working in a great industry like the video game business, which any kid out there listening would die to be in, I don't think they really realize how brutally hard that is and how you don't have a lot of creative freedom, and other people are telling you what to do, and you're not really your own boss, and there's a lot of layoffs, layoffs, layoffs. I mean, there's a graveyard of companies I've been through that didn't make it because they made bad decisions. And it took me 40, 45 years, I'd say, before I realized, well, what did that top guy do to get all of this? And I'm like, well, I could do that, right? So I left the industry, started my own company. And the first project I got to work on is Growums, which we didn't talk about in the previous interview, but that's out there. And that was a guy that had a great idea for a vegetable garden kit that it's like a themed vegetable garden kit, like a pizza garden would have tomatoes, seeds, basil,
Oh,
you know, bell
clever.
pepper, you know, four different seeds. And then I came in and produced 100 cartoons and created 75 characters that are way better than VeggieTales. And
Okay.
to teach the kids how to grow those seeds from seed to harvest, the
Clever.
little cartoons that they'd log in on
Clever.
and follow along. So to me, that was the most gratifying project I've ever been on up to that point. I mean, I love Mortal Kombat, don't get me wrong, but I love the idea that I could do something positive and everybody that I told would be behind it. That felt good. It took a lot of pressure off of me because I felt like I had a purpose, you know, getting kids excited about eating vegetables in a country that's got an obesity epidemic made a lot of sense to me. You know, I care about my health. I care about my health more than I care about my money. And so that was my first kind of touch on entrepreneurship. And I saw this guy again, a guy that I thought had all the skills that I didn't have doing it. Well, at some point that project ended and I realized, well, I could take all these skills of animating and come up with my own thing. So at the time I was going through a divorce. It was an unfortunate situation. I tried my best, but you know, people go in different ways, and I couldn't control what happened. And there I was stuck with, well, I shouldn't say stuck, but I was left with two brand new twin daughters the day they were born, and a three-year-old boy.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
I had three kids trying to figure out how to make it.
Babies.
How to survive. Not how kids. To do this on my own. Changing the diapers every so many, every half hour, I was doing something, you know, changing or sleeping. And I was struggling and frustrated with my life, really. Feeling really low, but had some optimism, you know, because I had to keep a positive face from my babies, you know, for my kids. I couldn't let them down. So it lit that fire under me like it did when I had no other options. I had no choice but to make sure my kids were okay. But you know what I noticed at the time? I noticed that there were no products out there that encouraged my kids to be good people. I couldn't find a single product. Like, where's the bed sheet that has a really awesome graphic print on it that has the instructions on how to make your bed worked into the print? Like, where's the light switch that would make it fun to turn off the lights and save power? Because my kids were always forgetting to turn the lights off. So where's that product? Where's the toy that's going to be positive and get my kids excited about their future? And that's when I had this epiphany. I thought, you know, I bet there's a lot of people just like me that are looking for something, and there's nothing that is backing their play as a parent. And Friendlians was born. So I created, first of all, I raised a lot of money and built my own Netflix, because I knew that nobody would like what I was selling in traditional media. I just knew no one's going to go for this. It's too good. Too many positive things happening here. So so I and I'm an unknown. So no one would take a risk on an unknown guy that has no track record. So I just built my own Netflix, my own network. And I raised the money for that. And then I produced 40 lessons. And these were life lessons that teach family values using evidence-based research on the best way to teach people, kids, how to do these things. So let me give you some of the subject matter that I hit. So I didn't want my kids to lie. So I have this one video that teaches kids what a lie is and why it's destructive and why your trust is lost when you lie. And your friends won't believe in you if you lie. And I do it in a very gentle way. And I have this little meter that goes between lie versus truth so that kids can understand the difference between a lie and a truth. And then the subjects like, what's a friend? You know, how do you know you've got a real friend? What's the value of elders? You know, how do you grow your own food? How do you cook your own food? And it's you know, there's that show, Gordon Ramsay, with the kids, getting them out there. And I'm always blown away that these kids that are 13, 14 are better than the adults and more well-behaved, I might add. And I just thought, there's a lot of information out there that the schools teach, the ABCs and the 1-2-3s, but the school systems are not, they're not designed to parent. That's not their job. But unfortunately, in the modern age, we've got both parents working. And so it just made sense to me that I would try to put this thing into the school systems so that when the teachers are struggling with a kid that doesn't want to listen or is bullying another kid, that they could plop them down in front of this video and learn something. And it could back up the teacher's play, even if it didn't help the parents. Well, I got number one top paid parenting app on the app stores in the first month of launching. And I got a Google's Choice Editor's Choice Award right out the gate. So I thought I was off the race. It's going to be a millionaire. But again, I wasn't motivated by money, so that didn't matter. But ultimately, I had to take the you know, COVID hit and the whole world changed, and I pulled it all down because it became very expensive to run. Luckily, I have had the joy of having Tess Cacciatore and Alex. They're both owners of this extraordinary new network called the World Trust Network. And it's the new network that's coming out, and it's very different from everybody else. In fact, it's two networks in one. So one side of it is an educational side that goes into the school systems, all the public school systems here in America, And we also have homeschooling. So even if you're a homeschooler, you'll have access to this private network. So there's a lot of people that can get access to Friendlings here in the near future, among other really amazing shows, educational shows that we're putting together. The other half of it is a public network. And if you've got a Roku device, you know, one of those streaming devices out there, we'll be sitting alongside Disney Plus and Hulu and Netflix. So the world will get access to this stuff. And it won't be just education, it'll be entertainment too. So and it's just wonderful to be a part of, you know, to be the anchor, the flagship show that is the first thing to be launched into the schools. Friendlings will be the anchor show that gets going. And to see how this is going to change a lot of lives in the school system means so much to me, because there's so many kids out there that are, they're stressed, they're depressed. There's a lot of fear. I mean, I hate to say it, but our leaders are not really giving us an optimistic future. You know, a lot of it's very pessimistic and a very, very scary world. Like, we won't be around in 10 years. Well, that's not the way Walt Disney thought. Walt Disney did not think that way. He thought optimistically. He was getting kids excited about rocketry and science and the hope of the love of, you know, the love of your country and your people, and celebrating the world's people with its small world, bringing us all together in unity. So I made it a life's mission to make Friendlians, and this is my mission statement for the project, is I want to teach children using evidence-based research how to be a good citizen in the world, where we teach them to work with other kids and the world around them in peaceful ways, despite our differences. And I think if I achieve even a small percentage of that with some kids, I will feel like I've done something in my life.
Yes,
I
yes.
I get emotional about it because it means so much to me. You know?
Well, thank you. And I'm glad you're getting emotional about it. I'm very excited about it. I'm grateful to Tess Cacciatore for introducing us. And I wish Tess and Alex and all the other team members all the best, and you all the best with World Trust Network, and that's coming to a TV and or a school near you. Now, actually, speaking of, we've got 2 minutes, and we've already gotten a sense of how we surpass our limitations, or how to get past our limitations, but you actually have some quick boom boom booms, maybe the top
right.
Three.
Let me give you the top three lickety-split in less than 2 minutes. So the first thing I did, you know, a lot of kids, they don't know what they want to do in life, you know, in high school. They're about to graduate. They still don't know. So the answer to that question is simple. Find out what you absolutely love. What do you do as a hobby when you're not doing your work or your job or whatever? What do you do on the side that gives you joy? Because if you think about it, you know, 60% of your life is going to be spent at a job. You might as well enjoy it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You probably should love it. And when you love your job, you're better at it. So that's the first thing. Find out what you love and then go after it. Don't be that sucker who forever got stuck in a job that they despise, and they're looking at the clock waiting for it to end. You know, when's the day going to end so I can clock out? Don't be that guy. I was that guy for 48 years, even though I was in the video game business. Ultimately, I was working for other people and I wasn't satisfied. You know, I have a job now where I wake up, there's not enough time in the day. The other thing is problem solving. There's going to be a lot of problems going to get in your path. So the thing I do is I write my problem at the top of a page. And then I sit in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I brainstorm every possible solution I can think of, even if it's a ridiculous solution and doesn't make any sense. I'll write it down. And then I'll order it from best chance of succeeding to the least chance of succeeding. And then I just start pulling the trigger on the first thing. And then if that doesn't work, I do the second thing. If that doesn't work, I do the third thing. Now, if your page is blank, that's when you got to learn how to control yourself, self-control. If you're going to be an entrepreneur, you need to have self-control and patience and a work ethic. And that's when you have that problem go in one ear and out the other. Because there's a lot of, most of the stress comes from people thinking they have control over their life, their problem, and they don't. They don't have any control. So I just shelve that. That doesn't mean I've forgotten about it, but it means I'll come back to it. Maybe there's a solution tomorrow. But I don't let it grind at me. I don't wring my hands over it, because that's just wasted energy. And finally, the most important thing is that you create something that does something for society. We have a lot of jobs out there that don't contribute to society. They contribute to you. And so I go back to my father's lesson. What you do for yourself dies with you, and you will be forgotten in history. No one will remember you. But I think we'll remember Walt Disney long after he's forgotten 100 years from now. People still remember that guy and what he did. So that's where I set my bar. It's a pretty high bar.
Well, you've achieved some of the things that you're already talking about that we can't talk about, in also because of a time limitation, at least this time around. But I took copious notes while we talked, and I've marked all the ones that I want to revisit someday with you when we can talk about them. In the meantime, I do want to let people know that your art is beautiful, and most of it, actually the majority of it, it can only be bought in stores on Disney properties. But the ones that
Not true. The Disney stuff is only exclusively at the parks. However, at wishpictures.com, my website.
That's what I was going to say.
Right. but I don't want to give people the impression the only way you can get it is in stores. So you can get it directly from me.
And there it is at wishpictures.com. You can find him on the socials at Joel Christopher Payne, P-A-Y-N-E. Christopher, there's so much to talk about. I'm just going to tease the word Santa Claus, and then we'll leave it.
Yes, I'm producing a Santa origin story called Elf King, and I've partnered with a friend of mine. He created the first sound card for Apple decades ago, and we've created talking toys, Toy Story for real, that interact with the show in real time, and we're looking for investors out there. So if anybody want to do a Santa origin story that rivals Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, reach out, because we got a lot of name actors that have connected themselves to it that we're really excited about. We just need funding.
And Joel, I have to say that Tess had spoken to me about you and your work many times, but it wasn't until, I don't remember if it was a year ago or if it was 2 years ago, but she showed me a picture of something related to the Elf King. And I said, "What is that?" And she says, "That's what I've been trying to tell you." I'm like, "But yeah, but look at that. That's amazing."
I have the winning lottery ticket when it comes to world building. I mean, I've done it for 28 years. So I'm really good at knowing what people, kids want, families want. But this story could change Christmas for all time and really set it back to its original meaning with St. Nicholas, which is that it was never about the toys. It was always about the selflessness. And so this show is going to really be transformative. It's got a really strong family message, something you don't see on TV anymore, kind of like Little House on the Prairie type morality in it. And we're
a lot of cool effects and great art and costumes.
Oh,
and
all the bells and whistles. all the fun stuff.
We'll have to save it for now. So artwork and more information about our guest is available at Wish Pictures, wishpictures.com, and then find Joel Christopher Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, on all the socials. Joel Christopher Payne, thank you so much.
It worked. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All the best
to you
until next time.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Tracy, and I'm lost and confused. My smartphone company has been shut down all day, and I'm concerned I won't be able to communicate with my loved ones during these extremely troubling times. What would you do in this kind of situation?
Dear Tracy, thank you for this important question. Let's remember that there are so many other ways besides the phone where we can communicate with our family and friends. I just experienced this challenge today when my daughter's phone no longer worked. I immediately used the internet to connect with her. We are fortunate that the internet gives us access to email, Instagram, Facebook, Telegram, and many other social networks that we can access to communicate with our family and our loved ones. I emailed her and she replied immediately because we had discussed that this could be a great choice if our phones are cut off. One can also research how to communicate during disasters if internet is not available, and you will find many alternative sources to assist you. GreatestSurvival.com has 10 interesting solutions that can help us stay in communication during challenging times. There are many other helpful websites providing solutions for this situation, such as SurvivalMom.com. I trust you will find one that works for you.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, please write her at AskDorothy@LifeChangesShow.com.
And we'll be right back with our performance guest, Hua Gall, here on the Life Changes Show right after this.
The Little Dog That Could is the fantastically true story of a man and a little dog that came into his life as his mentor to help him understand the world beyond his human senses and to experience life, love, and healing beyond his human understanding. Best-selling author Filippo Voltaggio, who currently hosts the highly regarded Life Changes show, is an internationally known singer, speaker, and life coach. Filippo offers up his own story, how one little surprise package in fur and four legs transformed his life unexpectedly forever and furthered his path of self-discovery. In The Little Dog That Could, Filippo brings to life the meaning of the adage, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Through the reading of this book, you will experience the journey of real miracles that transcend time, space, and logic while gaining practical tools that will help you navigate your way. The Little Dog That Could is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For more information, visit thelittledogthatcould.com. That's thelittledogthatcould.com.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening, someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
You are listening to A Conversation That Matters on The Life Changes Show. Broadcasting live from the heart of Los Angeles every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Share the journey with us at lifechangesshow.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Life Changes Show.
We're back, and our performance guest is, oh gosh, he's so many things. He's Hua Gall. He's a one-man band. And he's a multi-instrumentalist, of course, because he's the whole band. He is actually named Erwan Texier Hart. Welcome, Erwan, to the Life Changes Show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, and thank you for being with us in this very moment when we discovered that you are in this moment in France, and you had to set your alarm to wake up at, I think, 3:30 in the morning in order to do the interview. So thank you so much for doing that. And so we've got Hua Gall. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, Hua Gall. It's okay.
Hua Gall. Okay. And that's the name that you give to your project, because the project is actually something more different than we've seen. Usually a one-man band, we kind of know what it has, a harmonica or maybe a drum. But tell us about your one-man band experience.
Okay, so basically I play several instruments in the same time. I try to compose it there is a beat section, there is a bass section, and there is a harmonic section. And so usually I dedicate one or several limbs to to this purpose. So, for example, I have a live setup where I use a percussion called handpan. I play it with my hands. I use my mouth to play a didgeridoo, which is an Australian Aboriginal instrument. And I have synthesizer to do the bass, and I use my feet to make beat with bass drum, and also what is called it? Some kind of shaker, but on the ankle bells. And yeah, but yeah, I can perform several instruments at the same time. For example, of the guitar, I can play a beat, a drum beat on the body of the guitar, and I play bass and harmony with the other hands. And after, I can use other my hands to do other things. And yeah, I try to perform pieces that way.
So you were born in France?
Yeah, I'm French. I'm
You're
very
French.
French.
Okay. So the instrumentation, some of which you described and more that you use, some of the drums and all that, they're from other parts of the world and maybe even the language of another time, which we'll talk later. But where did the influence come for these other instruments when you started with what?
I started when I was a kid with cello and a little bit of piano, but like very child song and things like that. And after I started as a teenager to play on my own guitar. And after I taught myself several instruments such as percussion, handpan, Indian sitar, synthesizer, bass. Actually, what I do, kashakas also. Actually, all the instrument I play, I taught myself. And yeah, it's I love instruments of the world. I love world music, so I just play what fell in my hand. And after with years, I started to like collect in a way instrument, especially instrument that I can play with only one hand, for instance, so I can add it in the one man band project. And yeah, but basically the idea.
Well, let's hear a piece and give people an idea if they don't know your work, what we're talking about. So this first piece is called Ritual, and in a sense is. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Ritual is it's my personal ode to a very fragile, solemn, and ephemeral state that exists between a performer and his audience. So yeah, it's my tribute to this particular state, which is like in a way a communication. Like when I talk to someone is replying and like listening very actively. So this is basically the idea. This thing is going on when you perform live in front of the audience, and this is a very fragile state. So this song is about this because music is in a way some kind of a ritual. Because you always do the same thing, you always drive, you always like set up, you always play the song, and it's very different at every time, but there is like a common body of it. And yes, it's a ritual way of doing this, and music is always used for ritual purpose, so that's the idea.
Okay, so we're going to get to hear it now. This is pre-recorded. This is Wagal and Ritual here on the Life Changes Show.
Thank you.
Wagal. I'm going to spell that. It's W-A-A-G-A-L, and you can find Wagal at wagal.fr for France, F-R. Also, he has a link tree. So link tree is linktr.ee/Wagal, W-A-A-G-A-L. Speaking of ritual, I noticed that you have like ritual, the tribal mask on a lot of your videos, especially when you're performing live, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a way for me to protect myself. It's like an armor, a mask in a way, to like confront with the audience.
Wow. And where did you come up with that idea?
I'm some kind of shy people, so a shy guy. So when I perform in front of, or when I speak in front of a big audience, I tend to be like stressed. So for me, having like an armor, it's very important for me to be able to express myself like authentically, and also it's a way for me to. I'm very fond of prehistoric studies and music and reconstruction of language and music. So for me, it's also a way to connect with a primal past of humans, because face painting was and is still used from every country and every part of the world. So it's very interesting to see that face painting is a part of human legacy in a big sense, a big family.
Oh, very interesting. Very interesting. And so speaking also of tribal and ancient potential rituals, you have discovered something language-wise.
Yeah, this past year I released some song. Actually, I'm working since 3-4 years. I'm like a linguist enthusiast, so I do like linguistic research in my own time, and I discovered some old language, and interesting because I was also practicing throat singing in the shadow, let's say, in background, and it just connects themselves together. So now I use like very old language to try to revive them and borrowing them for the time of a song. And
you're using instruments that people don't normally see. You're singing in a language that we'll hear in a moment that most people won't understand, and yet you have an audience that is growing and growing and growing and growing. What do you think, in your words, the connection is that people are feeling and needing and wanting?
It's a challenging question. I don't know. I think I tend to see it as there is a lack of in Western country, there is a lack of some kind of spirituality, I guess. And I guess my work is like echoing some like very distant echo of like a remote past. And I have to precise that my music is not accurate as an historical thing, and it's not the purpose at all. But I try to just precise because there is a lot of misconception about it sometimes. And yeah, I think it's like echoing some distant past. And I think like people and humans in general just crave for meaning and understanding of these roots and legacy. And I guess my music can be some kind of medium of it. But for my personal way, it's more the thing is more like connecting the dot between all humans in the world and our shared legacy from prehistoric time. And the thing is that we have more similarity than difference. And so my music is just like some kind of artistic proposition, mixing and blending, like very ancient with very modern. And yeah.
Wonderful. And we're gonna get to hear even more of that and the throat singing. Where did you come up with the throat singing?
It's part of my like prehistoric musical research, and there is like throat singing in a lot of different parts of the world. We can find in, for instance, in Sardinia, which is a place of Italy. We can find in Mongolia. We can find it also in parts of Pakistan. Parts of Inuit people also do it. There's a lot of different kind of way of throat singing. There is also different time in Africa, just to name a few. And there is a lot of different way of doing it. And from my perspective, we could propose that it's like a prehistoric relicate that just survived to this day in some culture, and sometimes it didn't survive. And yeah, it was like because I'm not very interesting of singing like in like for example more mainstream way, let's say. And throat singing is more interesting for me to cast and to put like a specific energy or vibration, I don't know how to put it, but to be like more of a summoning or a ritual aspect of it. And yeah, I just like it, and I was working on it, and I think it's very interesting to use like my body for once, because usually I play instruments, so it's interesting for me, sorry, to have like a inner instrument. So it's funny because it also expose me more as a person, because it's my voice with a vocal technique, but it's my voice nevertheless. And so for me, which is shy, it's interesting to confront with this more personal aspect of it.
You know, I told you that when I was listening to one of your pieces, or the first piece I heard, I had this smile on my face, and I was experiencing it in a way that it was new to me and it was fresh, and I liked what you were doing with it, and I was sharing this with you when we spoke, and I felt a sense of like a child at discovering something new. And I wonder if you have that same experience sometimes, where almost like a child, you're saying, "Oh, here's a new toy. I wonder what it's going to sound like."
Yeah, it actually it's exactly like that.
Wow.
I'm just some kind of grown up child that just play with everything around, and most of it is music instrument, but there's so much way that we can do with it. And also we have to always like go thinking outside of the box, because usually when you play an instrument, there is one particular traditional way or mainstream way to play it. And but in life there is no rules, so you can always bend the rules. And I think my work as a musician is like experimenting with stuff. For example, I use all the body of my guitar to play guitar. I use all the instrument, but all sound that we can make to make things with it. And I think it's interesting to try to, okay, it's supposed to be played that way, but what sound can we make with it? And yeah, I like to experiment a lot.
Fun. Well, speaking of fun, we're going to get to hear this piece, which would be fun for me to try and pronounce, but I'm not going to. I'm looking at it. I can't make heads or tails of it. What language is this?
I can pronounce it if you want.
No,
The song
please do.
is called "Hrex Deiwos Kwe," and it's a song that use a reconstructed Proto-Indo-European language. The song is about it's like a short dialogue composed in this language. It's borrowed from and it's based on King Harishchandra, which is a king that features in the Rig Veda, which is a very old In ancient Indian text, it's one of the first actually text that was written in the Indo-European language. And so linguists, they used this section, this sample text, this text sample to make the reconstruction of this the common ancestor of all Indo-European language, which is called Proto-Indo-European again. And yeah, the song is based on it. And it's a little story of a king that asked his priest and after God to give him a son.
Okay, well, here is a pre-recorded version of that. By the way, are these songs that we've presented here today and this one, are they available?
Yeah, sure. This one is was released in this January, this past January.
Oh, wow. Okay. So here is Wagal. Please pronounce the name of the song again.
Rex Dei Vos Quae.
Okay. On the Life
King
Changes
and the
show.
God.
Have it, the king and the god, Wagal. Thank you so much for letting us share that piece with our audience. And you could learn more about him at wagal.fr, as in France, WAAGAL.fr. And then his link tree is Wagal, simply WAAGAL. And there you'll find all his socials, Spotify, YouTube. His links are all there. He's all over the place. I trust you're having fun with this because it looks amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, I have fun. It's interesting to experiment, especially when you are alone because you have no like limitation in a way.
Well, I have to ask you, I know it's late, so we won't keep you much longer, but I have to ask you, it's interesting how you said earlier how you consider yourself a shy person, and yet you were a street performer.
Yeah.
That sounds like it's hard or very hard for a shy person, and that you actually didn't necessarily want to leave it, but you had to because you got busy doing festivals.
Yeah, it's I think it's interesting because life always challenges you, and for me it was this thing that can help with it. And yeah, street performance and performance in a broader sense, it's always like teaching me how to handle it. And yeah, it's a good challenge for me. Even if I now tends to be more comfortable with it, it's always like a lesson to be learned. And yeah. And street performance was very interesting because it connects directly with people without this barrier between artist and audience. So it was interesting and a good challenge and a good school in a way.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you're doing festivals now. I hope I get to catch you live in a festival, but I'm so glad we got you live here on the Life Changer Show. What a pleasure, Erwan.
Me too. Thank you.
Help me with your last name. Let me just try it, and then you could correct me.
You got it right first time, actually.
I did?
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Okay, then I won't try it again. No. Yeah. Erwan Textier-Hart.
Yeah, Erwan Textier-Hart. Nice.
Okay. And then Waagal, Waagal. Remember that. And enjoy his music. Waagal, I hope you get back to sleep. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. See you next time.
Our pleasure. With a big thank you to Erwan Textier-Hart, otherwise known as Waagal. And another big thank you to Joel Christopher Payne. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejeur, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at The Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.